Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by the Isley Brothers, the Carpenters, the Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, this is Mark Lee Morrison from the podcast Low Profile. I live in Olympia, Washington with my wife and two daughters, and I support Vish Khanna's creative control on Patreon because I appreciate his journalistic integrity. Vish talks with a lot of artists I care about, and he never asks any boring questions. I love hearing his interviews, and as a Patreon supporter, I get to hear even more of them. If you enjoy creative control too, I implore you to join me as a sustaining contributor.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today.
Please consider supporting Black Women United, YEG, for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. You can learn more about them at bwunited.ca. They are always looking for donations and volunteers. So please, again, support Black Women United, YEG, for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. Again, that website is bwunited.ca. Joe Wong is a musician, composer, producer, and well-regarded podcast host based in California. A dynamic drummer who's performed with many artists and within various genres, he's also composed the scores for TV shows like Master of None, Russian Doll, and The Midnight Gospel, as well as documentaries like Independent Lens and 6 Days to Air. Wong is the host of the interview podcast The Trap Set, which began as a showcase for influential and prominent drummers in conversation, but has since expanded to feature other musicians. All of these experiences have fed into Wong's debut solo album, Night Creatures, an ambitious and intricately orchestrated collection of psychedelic rock and pop music, all co-produced by Mary Timoney of Helium, and featuring contributions by Mary Lattimore, Stephen Drozd of The Flaming Lips, Anna Waronker of That Dog, and Craig Wedren of Shudder to Think, among others. Night Creatures is available now via Decca Records, and Joe and I caught up recently to have a chat about the sound and lyrical intent on this record. Creative fear, creative compulsions, and theories about drummers and their behavioral psychology, the trap set, podcasting and interviewing, future plans, and much more. a part of the Entertainment One Network with the support of listeners like you who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it, and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol and Massey Hall's concert film series live at masseyhall.com, where you can stream dozens of 30-minute films for free, including performances by past podcast guests like Jennifer Castle, plus in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton. This is the 567th episode of Creative Control, featuring the multi-talented Joe Wong with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hey, Joe, how's it going?
Not bad. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for asking. Where in the world are you?
I'm in Pasadena, California.
Oh, boy. How are things going in Pasadena, California? I said, oh, boy, because there are fires and earthquakes in California these days and social unrest and a pandemic and all sorts of things. How's life going for you?
Well, luckily, my life is great. I'm doing fine. I feel the psychic weight of all of the things that you mentioned. I can't go outside and run until the middle of the night when the air clears up. But aside from that, I'm very fortunate.
That's great. That's great to hear. I feel the same. I'm working from home a lot here. I'm calling from Edmonton, Alberta. Have you ever been to Edmonton, Alberta or Canada generally?
Well, I've been to Calgary, Alberta, but I have not been to Edmonton.
Oh, cool. What brought you to Calgary?
There was a music fest that I played.
Was it Sled Island by chance?
Yes, it was Sled Island.
It's a lovely... Did you have a good time?
Yeah.
Now, how long ago was that you played Sled Island?
I think it was 2011.
Oh, cool. Yeah, so weirdly enough, the first and only time, I guess, I attended Sled Island was in 2012. I'm originally from Ontario, so I just moved to Alberta in January, but I did attend the Sled Island Fest and... Yeah, it's cool. Just so people are clear, and we'll get to this. You do lots of different things. You're known by some as the host of the Trap Said podcast. You're known by others as a musician. Some know you for doing both, I suppose. Do you consider yourself first and foremost a musician at this point?
Sure.
Well, I guess I sometimes wonder what the side hustle is, but you are a very accomplished musician. You've scored various things for Netflix and whatnot. So principally, you consider yourself a musician. What is your background in music exactly, Joe?
Well, I started playing piano when I was 6 years old. Before that, I was a huge music fan. I can remember listening to records on my Fisher-Price turntable as young as age 3 or 4. And I played piano and then in school later played violin and clarinet. But then at age 11, I discovered the drum set. And that really felt like my vehicle into the larger world of music. It was the first instrument that I played that really felt related to the kind of music that I was listening to and made it feel as though...
Now, when you say the music, first of all, I'm also a drummer, if I may. I had sort of a similar epiphanies. I started a bit later than you by the sounds of it. When you say the music that you heard, with playing the drums sort of felt like, you could relate more to the music you were hearing. What kinds of music were you hearing and how did it relate to the drumming that you were doing?
Well, I wasn't particularly listening to clarinet music when I was playing clarinet, for example. Subsequently, I love Benny Goodman and such, but I wasn't listening to that at the time. I was listening to pop music, most of which has a beat. So it felt easily translatable. It felt like I could exist in that world.
Now, before that, one thing I've noticed or I've kind of come to terms with as a drummer is, on some level, people don't always regard drummers this way, but you're kind of central The drummer is very integral to everything else going on stage, I'd like to think. I don't know if that's just my bias as a drummer, but do you have a perspective on the role of the drummer in a configuration of any kind? Again, we both might have a bias here, but don't you think the drummer is particularly important to any ensemble?
Well, I think if it's a great ensemble, everybody is of equal importance. But, you know, the drummer historically plays a foundational role. You know, they always say that you can't have a great band without having a great drummer. So, you know, in the same sense that you can't build a house with a shaky foundation, you can't build a band with a shaky foundation.
Right.
That said, I mean, I think that that can mean several different things. And in some cases, I don't think of the drummer in that role. You know, there are certain cases where the drummer is playing more of a melodic role. So it just depends. But of course, I love drummers.
Well, yes, and you've interviewed some of the finest people to ever do it.
I will say that I think drummers are often undervalued. So maybe your bias is in a response to that. I mean, I can say as somebody that, as you mentioned, has spoken to lots of drummers, you know, they're often the ones cast aside from a band that they helped make great. That you don't see that happening as frequently with vocalists or even guitar players. So I think that the drummer's value is underappreciated.
So one of the things I was alluding to in terms of reflecting upon my choice in taking on the drums, which for me in my city that I grew up in was kind of out of necessity. Everyone was trying to play guitar. So my friends and I were like, well, somebody's got to play drums. So we looked in like do you have the Penny Saver? Like a classified ad newspaper. Do you guys have that? Yeah, you have that? Yeah.
So I don't know if it still exists, but yeah, I remember it.
Yeah, I don't know if it does either. But we looked in it and someone was selling like a $300 drum kit. So we pooled our money and we brought it to a garage. And then I took to it. Like I just got on it and I could kind of do it. Like not great, but you know, I was a kid. But that's kind of how I started playing. But as you talk about drummers being cast aside and undervalued, I think there's a power dynamic thing going on there. Because in sort of reflecting upon myself and maybe control issues I've had in the past and that I'm trying to reconcile, the drummer is kind of a controlling role, isn't it? I mean, if the drummer's having an off day or can't play well, that the whole thing kind of suffers. That's kind of what I'm not suggesting it's necessarily a great thing that it's such an integral role, but it is integral in that regard. If the drummer's off, things go south. So do you have those feelings about yourself? Like, when you think about yourself, did you gravitate towards the drums because you wanted to assert some sort of leadership role in your life and in these configurations?
No. I just got a visceral joy from playing drums that I hadn't experienced with other instruments. And if I go deeper into the psychoanalysis, I don't really think that it has to do with wanting to control things.
Okay.
That said, I've noticed that lots of drummers are often, you know, the logistical minds of the bands that they're associated with, and often are the ones kind of in charge of, say, anything from packing the van to the business concerns of the band.
Yeah, exactly.
And I've also noticed that lots of drummers have become good composers. And I think it takes two qualities that are common between composers and drummers are an enormous amount of empathy. As a drummer, you have to understand what the songwriter, if it's not you, is trying to express, and you have to be able to bolster that message. And also, I think drummers tend to have a more analytical mind than other members of the band, and I think that helps as a composer.
Yeah, but the rap, the jokes about musicians are often either at the expense of the drummer or the bass player, aren't they, generally? We are ridiculed for our leadership skills, because I agree with you. I was always the one booking the tours, you know, settling up at the end of the night, packing the van, you know. There's something going on there with drummers, I think. I know you poo-pooed my idea a little bit, but then you went on to say, actually, yeah, like there's something going on there. So, yeah, I'm curious because you've had to think about drummers a lot as a drummer and in your work. I'm sure it's fascinating. It's a fascinating role, isn't it?
Sure. I think that drummers the fascination with the podcast started because I think drummers are the least interviewed members of the band. So there was untapped gold there. Mm.
And are you still the trap set is going? It's a going concern. Are you still enjoying it?
Yeah. After 200 episodes, we expanded the scope to include all musicians. And at the beginning of the pandemic, I expanded to daily episodes because for the first time, I decided to try recording over the phone or over FaceTime. And, some of the guests that we had during that first month of daily episodes included folks like Flea, Sharon Van Etten, Angel Olsen, Billy Gibbons of ZZ Top, et cetera. And so that was really fun, and it kind of breathed new life into the podcast. And the most recent episode, we kind of returned to our roots and had one of the great drummers, Steve Jordan.
Yeah.
But I've been taking a short hiatus because I've been working on promoting the album I just made.
Yeah. It's a lovely album. It's called Night Creatures. And I'm hoping you can talk a little bit about its conception. Where did this start? Where did the idea for this particular record begin for you?
I just had a yearning to make an album, to make a personal statement. At the time that I started writing it, I was also scoring the show Russian Doll, and it was inspiring to see Natasha Lyonne, who co-created that show, make a personal statement. And previously, she had been known as a great actor for many years, but this was the first really vulnerable personal statement that she'd made as kind of an auteur. Hmm. And I think I took a cue from that, and also just my, internal compass was pointing in that direction. And, it's something I'd wanted to do for a good decade, but just for whatever reason, hadn't had the wherewithal to do so. And I asked myself why I'm able to write hundreds of hours of music for other people every year, but not make my own statement. And, I think the answer is that it requires a different level of vulnerability to be the arbiter of whether it's working or not. When I'm working for somebody else, they're the arbiter, and I'm there to help heighten their vision or elevate their project. But when I'm left to my own devices, then my neuroses kick in. So what I ended up doing and what ended up working for me is setting up a structure not unlike my scoring routine, wherein I had a finite amount of time. I brought in somebody to help produce, the great Mary Timoney, so that I would be accountable to a person other than myself and would have a structure to work within. And it worked great.
In terms of that structure, how was that kind of established or implemented? What did Mary bring to the proceedings that guided you in such a way?
Well, I'm just used to getting feedback from other people when I work on music, whether it's a filmmaker or a showrunner. And I think it can be useful to have external ears on the project. So I brought in somebody who had made several records that I love and who has been doing it for 30 plus years, and somebody whom I have a close relationship with as a friend and whose aesthetic closely matches mine. Hmm. So she was the perfect person for the project. And she was, my champion at times. She was the person that I could turn to if I thought something could be better for validation that was true. Or, she was also the person to tell me that enough's enough, move on, you've got the take. Just the act of flying her out here and booking a studio outside of my own regular studio made everything feel more deliberate. I had a time and a place to work on this record that was, reserved specifically for this record rather than trying to fit it in spare time around other projects.
Right. The studio you used was in Joshua Tree, California, I believe. What was that like? I've never been. I mean, a lot of us know of it because of the album made by U2 and other music lore, I suppose. What was it actually like to be in Joshua Tree? My understanding is the studio is kind of isolated, right?
Right, and that was the idea. But Joshua Tree is a great place. The studio itself was like slightly outside of Joshua Tree proper. And it was a great sounding room, and that's really all we needed. But Joshua Tree has, you know, mystical outsider vibes, some really great places to eat and hang out, and not much else outside of the beautiful park, yeah. In the way of distractions. So it was just a place to go that felt like it fit the vibe of the album.
Right.
And it was outside of my normal working environment.
Right.
Which was really helpful.
Right. So in terms of this, the vibe of the album, which you just referenced, I'm wondering if you can characterize it. I've seen people describe it as, you know, psychedelic rock. You know, when I listen to it, I hear echoes of the Beatles and the Beach Boys and the Zombies, you know, kind of along the lines of sort of mid to late 60s studio exploration and orchestral arrangements, these kinds of things. But I'm curious, how would you characterize the sound of Night Creatures?
Orchestral psychedelic pop music is a reductive characterization. I wouldn't characterize it, but since I have to, that's how I would characterize it.
Okay.
It wasn't something where I had a particular aesthetic in mind that I was seeking out. I think it was really just the product of my personal taste. And obviously all the groups that you mentioned are bands that I love dearly, along with lots of others. But, it was just songs that I heard in my mind. It wasn't like I set out to write a particular type of record. But I think because I'm often working with orchestrations as a film and TV composer, that's something that I'm, you know, uniquely qualified to work with in these songs. And it's something that I heard in my mind from the start. So that was what factored into the decision to use those instruments.
So how does the sound of this record relate to some of your recent compositional work, your scoring work, and maybe previous releases of your own? I'm just curious if it feels like a departure for you, or does it feel like it's part of a continuum?
Well, to me, it feels like it's part of a continuum because it's the part of the continuum of my consciousness. But I definitely think, you know, it's certainly different from any of the bands that I've played in as a drummer. The last artist that I played with as a drummer was Marnie Stern, who's a guitar shredder, who makes, you know, her own brand of wonderful music. But I don't really see any commonalities between what I'm doing and what she was doing. And similarly, I don't see any much of a through line from my other longstanding band, Parts and Labor, which I played drums in, to this. But I'm sure that those experiences informed what I was doing to some extent. It's just not obvious to me. But I'm sure that everybody that I've ever played with is on there at some point. As far as it relating to my composition work, I mean, I think it's just very different in the sense that the intention is different. With composition work, again, I'm there to kind of build a piece of couture music to somebody else's parameters. You know, it's like being an architect or cooking a meal for somebody else, whereas this is like making a sculpture or cooking a meal for myself. So the intention is very different, but I think the skill set that I developed as a composer is it translates.
It seems to me that maybe over the past decade, you have been utilizing your skills and your drive to showcase other people, like, or rather to bring other people's visions to fruition. Like when you talk about the scoring work and the compositional work you're doing for others, you're helping someone there. You're working with them. And when I think about your podcast, the way I think about my podcast is that it feels less about me and more about more something for my guest. You know, I feel like I have this role to play, but it doesn't really, I've never really viewed it as something to further me. I like kind of the fulfilling part is that I'm spreading the word about someone else's work. And it just seems to me that, I don't know if you agree with that in terms of your own trajectory, but it seems to me that Night Creatures is something that kind of like a pent up expression. You've been, it is you finally after about a decade of showcasing other people and giving them the spotlight. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I think that's true. I definitely think that there are elements of me in everything that I've done up until now. And I think allowing that to happen is important. I mean, it's true that my podcast is largely a platform to help tell the stories of other people, but I would think that my way of interacting with those people gives those stories a unique structure, or mm-hmm. it makes it a unique platform. Mm-hmm. So there's an element of me there. And also I'm the one that's curating the show largely. So it correlates with my own personal taste. And then as far as, you know, playing drums in other people's bands, you know, in many cases I was not the primary songwriter. So although there are creative elements to the way that I'm playing drums, I'm functioning more like an actor and less like a writer, you know, which is a creative, you know, obviously being an actor is a creative endeavor, but it's an interpretive endeavor. Mm-hmm. I think drumming in bands where I didn't write the songs is similar to that. And then, you know, as a composer, I think, especially recently, I'm composing music that I'm uniquely qualified mm-hmm. to write, mm-hmm. but it's in service of somebody else's vision, ultimately.
Yeah.
So I think you're right. I think that this album is, as close to a distillation of who I am as anything I've put out. But that said, you know, I think it's not something that's generated by me. It's something that, you know, comes from somewhere else and is filtered through my experience, if that makes sense.
It does. It does make sense. And I know you alluded to this earlier and again, sort of just now, but I want to home in on what exactly prompted this, let's call it a shift from working on things that were more or less in service of other people to focusing again on yourself a little bit and working with the people you worked with to bring your own vision to fruition here. What do you reckon, and within this, I hope we can get into some of the lyrical content here. What do you suppose it was that actually finally spurred you out of that mode of doing work with and for other people into expressing yourself? What did you need to say at this point, Joe?
Well, as I mentioned before, I was scoring simultaneous to making this album, mm-hmm. so I wouldn't characterize the two endeavors as mutually exclusive,
okay.
right?
Okay, sure.
But to answer your question, I think I was just ready to do it, and I think that the podcast in particular, making my podcast, helped prepare me. I think of each of the conversations I have as kind of like a rung in a ladder that pulled me out of a kind of creatively dark place that I was in when I started the show. I think when I started the podcast, I had been touring quite a lot for many years. I started touring when I was 17, and when I started the podcast, I was 34 or 33. And I wasn't experiencing any kind of visceral joy by playing music at that point. It was a muted joy mm-hmm. Or some sort of intellectual satisfaction, but it felt kind of like a companionate marriage. The thrill was gone. The excitement was gone. And I was asking myself if that was sufficient. Is that enough to sustain me for the rest of my life? Or was what I was feeling, what was it? What was that feeling trying to tell me? Was it that I should move on to something else entirely? Was it that something was wrong that I needed to fix? And I think by having conversations, asking other musicians if they'd ever experienced similar things, and simply by having conversations and interacting with people face to face for an hour at a time every week, and by releasing that out into the world every single week for several years, I kind of set up another system of accountability where, you know, there were folks that wanted to talk to me and there was an audience for the show. And I was able to kind of work through my neuroses with my musical heroes too, and learn that I was not alone in that feeling. And through doing that, I kind of decided that I was going to give it another go. And, like I said, I realized that I had the skill set to write songs. So something else was blocking me, some sort of, you know, psychological problem or fear. And that's why I kind of set up that structure that I spoke about before to kind of circumvent that fear or better equip myself to face it.
Do you have a, and I don't mean to pry, but you broached it, so I'll follow up here. Do you have a sense now of where that fear emanates from, and do you have a better handle on that fear now?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the fact that I successfully created the album and made it something that I like is huge, and it just propels me to want to make more. Hmm. One of the things that I learned through doing the podcast, and I can remember having this conversation with Sheila E., is that that fear is the North Star. You want to head towards it.
Oh.
And that's what that's her philosophy, is whatever she's kind of, whatever is giving her butterflies and what she's scared about, that's what she moves towards, because that's the creatively fertile ground.
Well, that's
proven to be true.
Yeah, some people in their vocational lives, that fear is a fear of failure. But when we make things or do things in public, whether you're a musician or you host a podcast, you're kind of learning in public. So the other fear within that fear of failing is the fear of humiliating yourself, I suppose. I know they can be kind of similar fears in a sense, but do you know what I mean? Like, do you see the distinction between the two, like this public work we do?
Yes. I don't know that that's the center of what I was afraid of. I think that I'm just really, really hard on myself historically. Mm. And I think that was a benefit that benefited me for a long time, but I think it had gotten me to a place where I had achieved, very advanced technical skills in certain areas, but I was not asking myself what those skills were in service of, So I wanted to steer myself to a place where those skills could be used to make a statement. Hmm.
In terms of the podcast and what, you mentioned you learn things by talking to musicians, and that has informed a certain kind of fearlessness as a player, as a composer, and that's heartening to hear. We kind of talked a little bit about potential musical influences on you. Do you have broadcasting or interviewer influences per se?
Yeah, but first I want to say that I don't think that I have a fearlessness. I just think I'm more comfortable pursuing the things that make me scared and feel, and I'm accepting that those are the things that will probably produce the most interesting life for myself.
Okay.
Whereas before I wouldn't. But as far as broadcasting influences, around the time that I started doing the podcast, Mark Maron's show was just starting to take off, and I really liked listening to that while I was on tour. And I've always been a huge fan of Terry Gross. And I think I try to fall somewhere in between the two of them as far as interview style is concerned, whereas Mark rarely prepares for interviews and is very good at just being in the moment with somebody and kind of zoning in on people's emotional state. Terry Gross is really methodical and prepared. And so, I've found that my style probably fits somewhere, between the two approaches.
Okay. Now, do you hear, do you edit your own show? If I may get behind the curtain a little bit, do you edit your own podcast?
No, I have an editor called Chris Karwowski. And I met Chris because he was an Onion writer for many years, and we were friends in New York. And he has a great narrative sense as a writer and is not a professional musician. And kind of one of the important things about our show that I think distinguishes us from other music shows is that I'm not interested in talking about the minutia of, you know, technique or too much about process. It's more about the life that informs the process. So by having Chris involved, we could kind of shape the narrative to be hopefully more universally appealing.
Right. I asked about the editing because I have found in editing myself that it teaches you what to do and not to do a bit, because you're stuck with yourself in your head and you're like, dude, like, why are you, you know, over the years, I hope I've improved. Do you have a sense that you have gotten better at it? And if so, can you identify things that bolster that feeling, like, oh, I used to do a thing and now I don't do it anymore. Do you have that feeling about your own work as a podcaster?
I think I'm a better listener now, and I try to speak less than I used to before. So I think those are the main ways that I've improved.
Was there anything in particular that sparked that sort of realization? Because as I say, like, for me, it's week in and week out of doing this. That's what I learned too, that the real art of interviewing someone is listening, not necessarily talking, which I don't know that, I think that's sort of spreading now, that feeling, like you got to listen. So were there particular episodes or was there a moment where you're like, yeah, you know what, I got to make a bit of a shift in how I approach this?
No, I don't think there was any sort of conscious thought that went into it. I think it just happened slowly over the course of doing the show for, I guess it's now coming up on 6-7 years.
Oh, congratulations. That's great.
Thanks.
Do you ever let's just have a podcast to podcast chat here, head to head. Does it ever feel daunting to do this in this climate where so many of these things exist? And, you know, you mentioned taking a bit of a hiatus so you could talk about this record that you made. And I don't really take those kinds of breaks. So sometimes I wonder why. I should probably take a break every once in a while. Even when I go on vacation, I pre-schedule these things. And I'm like, why am I doing this? Do you ever have these philosophical questions about, you know, why am I doing this right now in this crowded field? Do you have those thoughts?
Well, I would say for the first 5 years, we did weekly episodes, come rain or shine. And I was glad to do that. I think it was really healthy. But, you know, it's my podcast. And, you know, ultimately, I have to follow my gut. And if I'm feeling like something else is more creatively interesting, I don't want to just go through the podcast by rote. I want to make sure that I'm engaged. So if my attention needs to be on something else, I can take a little break. And I think we've earned that, you know, coming up on 300 episodes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, maybe I should take your advice. I'm almost at 600 episodes. No real breaks. I take breaks when there are illness or tragedies or things like that. But even then, I feel compelled to keep going. It's a compulsion. I've talked to a few. I remember having the fellows from Silkworm on. Do you know that band Silkworm?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And they were talking about this, like, you know, they've both kind of just keep making records and keep writing songs. Sometimes after declaring they're not going to do it anymore, it's a compulsion and they can't quite stop it. I mean, I'm sure you've encountered that drive in some of the subjects you've interviewed. You seem to have a more rational take on it. If I need to take a break from this, I can come back to it. But do you see how some people don't seem to see it that way? Like they just have to make things no matter what?
Yeah, definitely. And I would say that I fall into that category. I mean, if I'm taking a break from the podcast, it's because I'm working 90 hours a week writing music. But I also recognize that I don't really want to be compulsive about making things. I want it to come from a place of I want to desire to make something. Otherwise, what's the point? It has to give me some sort of joy or illumination in some way. Otherwise, I'm just not interested in doing it. But I do know that, you know, if I look at my life for the last 30 years, that I can just trust that I'll find things that I want to make. But I don't think I need to make the podcast just to do it, you know, or just to be consistent. I think that would be a disservice to my listeners if I wasn't really engaged in doing it.
No, that's fair. Absolutely fair. I just wonder about this sort of compulsion among all creative people, not simply in this realm of podcasting or radio making or, but I mean, like I say, when I talked to authors and, you know, musicians, and they're just like, yep, you know, at the end, I'll do it to you too. I'll probably say, what's next? There's always something. Very rarely does someone say, I have nothing or I haven't thought about the next thing yet. You know, it's just fascinating. We're workers. And anyway, I think that's interesting in itself.
I think it's important because sometimes making things can be really difficult. It's important to set your mind to it and see it through to the end. And so that's maybe the genesis of that feeling that you're describing as a compulsion in some people.
Yeah.
But I think it can become unhealthy when it's central to your identity. You know, for example, you see yourself as a podcaster primarily and not a person. And so in order to maintain that identity or that notion of yourself, then you just feel like it's necessary to keep making things. That's when it can get tricky.
Yeah. I feel like this is now a self-inflicted intervention that I started. No, I'm kidding. No, it's very insightful on your part for sure. I want to ask you about some of the lyrical inspiration here. First of all, I want to send you my condolences about the loss of your father. My understanding is your father passed away in 2019. Is that correct?
Yes. Thank you.
Yeah. Can you please discuss your father's role in terms of inspiring some of the songs, if not all of the songs, on Night Creatures?
Well, I wrote the lyrics in kind of a free associative state, and I didn't even realize that it was about my dad until after it was done. So it wasn't as though I was writing this as a tribute to him consciously or that I wanted to tell a story consciously. It really came from the subconscious depths. But it would make sense that that would be an inspiration because it was a big part of my life for several years. My dad got sick in 2010, and for the first couple of years that he was sick, I was managing his life. I had powers of attorney, and it was a big part of my life trajectory. It was like a full-time job managing his life on top of what I was doing as a composer and musician at the time. And so I think it weighed heavily on me for many years. And when you lose somebody slowly to a degenerative disease, it was like losing somebody piece by piece over the course of 9 years. So it seems obvious that that would be the source of some of these lyrics, although I wasn't setting out to, you know, chronicle my story.
So you're saying that, yeah, as you say, this may have seeped in subconsciously. On a conscious level, now that the record's out, do you have a perspective on things that are swimming around in here? There's lots of sort of sleeping stuff and, dreams, these kinds of things, and horrors, nightmares even. I mean, Night Creatures has maybe a double meaning in some sense, but do you have a perspective on what's kind of going on now that now that people have processed the record and it's out in the world?
Well, for me, it's an album of coming to terms, or the lyrical themes have to do with coming to terms with mortality. And I think our society is, if you view it through a certain lens, it's primarily set up to make us forget that we're going to die. I mean, the knowledge of our own mortality is one of the few essentially human qualities, but it's something that we try to obscure in our culture. And I think after being with somebody as they're dying and holding their hand as they're dying, it definitely took death off of a pedestal for me, as somebody who was raised in an agnostic household and had a pretty firm relationship with existential dread from a young age. It felt like a natural process and kind of a beautiful process and a release. And so I think that that comes out in the songs. You know, there's a line in the first song, Dreams Wash Away, the weight of will slowly diminishes. And, I think a lot about how this notion of, you know, agency over our own lives is something that we grasp onto with a tight fist, but it's also a burden. You know, this idea that we're responsible for our own lives. And it also might be an illusion too, you know, because we might merely be the product of our genetics and our environment, neither of which we have control over. So those are some thoughts that have come to mind after I wrote the album. And it was funny because I started thinking about it when we were rehearsing last year with the band, and during a break, everybody was talking about somebody that they love dying. And I was like, wait, why is everybody talking about this? But I guess that's when I started to realize that the lyrics, evoke that.
Ah, so you weren't even consciously aware that maybe that was going on and your bandmates picked up on it. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Huh. That's fascinating in itself. You know, I was thinking about your singing on this record because often the imagery is very vivid, emotive, for sure. But you haven't, I would say, for, you know, I hope you will accept this observation. You have a very even way of delivering these lyrics on this record. Like, it's a very calm delivery given again, this is not this is a meant to be something of a compliment. It's fascinating to me that the lyrics that I'm processing are fairly loaded with things, you know, ideas and images, but you're very like serene. You're kind of calmly singing. Can you talk about the relationship between the lyrics and your approach to delivering them, and I guess even your approach to singing generally?
Well, again, there was no conscious thought put into my delivery. This is the first time I've tried singing on an album, aside from some backing vocals here and there. So I was just learning as I went, and I was trying to just go inside of the songs and sing them the way I felt them. But if I zoom out and kind of answer your question about the seeming kind of disparity in between the delivery and the lyrics, that sounds great to me. I mean, I'm a big fan of, songs that have that kind of duality. You know, for example, a song that has really happy major chords and really dark lyrics, for, you know, off the top of my head, I like those kind of songs, or songs that are really dark and moody, but with uplifting, beautiful lyrics.
Yeah.
So, so I'll take the compliment.
Yeah, it is a compliment.
I will say it wasn't something that I did consciously. I was really quite literally just trying to learn how to sing as I went.
Well, I appreciate that you in sort of describing other examples of such a thing. I think you can appreciate that I'm sort of seeing it as an interesting and fascinating bit of tension, the tension between the intent and the delivery, I guess. And it adds a lot to the songs, if I might say.
Well, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome, Joe. Now, you did play some shows, right? Before the pandemic, before the lockdown, you were able to play a little bit and bring this to the stage. Is that correct?
We played one show, and it was a great show. It was really fun. But it was intended to kind of be a rehearsal for the tours that have now been postponed. It wasn't a rehearsal, but it was intended to be kind of like a trial run.
Warm up show.
Out everything.
Warm up show.
I don't want to say warm up because that would make it seem like we weren't doing our best for the people that were there. But you know what I mean. It was kind of like a proof of concept. Yeah.
No, I mean, you gotta figure out what it's like on its, you know, put it on its feet at least once before you book a tour, I'm sure, right?
Yeah, and it's a relatively logistically complicated project. You know, there were 20 people on stage,
yeah,
for one thing. So I just had to work that all out before we could book a tour.
Yeah, that's fair. So as I've been speaking with other musicians and other people who are used to traveling to spread the word about whatever they've made, what's your, yeah, tell me about your mindset. Night Creatures is, as I said, it's out, it's available now as a record, but how do you spread the word about it in isolation? What do you have plans for you know, live streams and these kinds of things?
Last week I recorded a set of music, a kind of stripped back acoustic set with a string quartet and the keyboard player that plays in my band, and it was really fun. So hopefully we can do more things similar to that. And then, you know, another way that the word has been spread about this album has been because the first song on the album was featured in a TV show that I composed called The Midnight Gospel. And that exposed millions of people to the song in a really great way, because the show was really in sync with my own aesthetic and my own and the place in my life that I was at the time. The episode that has the song is an animated podcast conversation between the co-creator of the show, Duncan Trussell, and his mother as she was dying. So it was really like a synchronous collaboration. And I found out that I was going to start working on the show as I was driving to the airport to go say goodbye to my dad. So there was something there. I think it's beyond coincidence that I worked on that show with those people. And it was a great experience. And luckily they wanted to use one of my songs in the show.
Yeah, a lot of kismet there, or whatever you want to call it, in your work, it seems. You know, things dovetailing in interesting ways. It's rare for me to have someone like yourself on the show who occupies realms that are both, you know, deeply impacted by the pandemic, creative realms. So, I mean, you are involved often in TV and film productions. And you are, hopefully, if all goes, when things are going well, you're a touring musician. How busy are you as a working composer and musician at the moment, given that, you know, touring is pretty much frozen at the moment? I assume some TV productions are, as we're speaking, maybe back. I'm not sure. How busy are you right now, Joe?
Well, I'm really fortunate to be just busy enough. I'm working on 4 projects right now versus last year around this time, maybe 7 or 8.
Okay.
So I'm working 40, 50 hour weeks instead of 80, 90 hour weeks, and I'm enjoying it. It's giving me time to write the next album. And it's incredibly lucky that I have these opportunities. So many great musicians who have been on my show are just kind of lost until there's a vaccine.
Yeah.
And so I every day I feel really lucky that I have the opportunities that I have.
Yeah, I'm for what it's worth, I feel the same. And that's heartening to hear. So in keeping with this, what is next for you in terms of your podcast? It sounds like you're working on music, as you just said, but if you want to add anything else in terms of maybe Night Creatures related films, videos, things, what's coming up? I have no idea what you're up to beyond this moment, Joe. Please tell us.
There are 3 Night Creatures videos in the can, music videos. One was directed by Fred Armisen, whom you may know from Portlandia and SNL, etc.
Great drummer. And then, fantastic drummer.
A drummer, yeah. And a former guest of my podcast.
Yeah, I talked to Fred. I talked to Fred once when he was... Were you a fan of his fake drummer character? Or whatever you want to call it?
Yeah. And actually, I was lucky enough to get to co-produce his stand-up special about his life as a drummer.
Oh.
Stand-up for drummers.
Oh, nice.
So I'd worked with him on that. Actually, that was another inspiration for making my album, because he was being openly personal in a way that I don't think he had before.
I see.
So it was interesting seeing him make that statement. But so he directed the video for the title track of the album, and that was just completed. And then we have two videos that kind of run continuously one into the next for the songs Minor and Nuclear Rainbow, which also run one from the next on the album.
Yep.
Run to the next on the album. And then, like I said, I recorded a set in my backyard last week that looks great, and that's just being put together right now. And I'm writing the next album, and it looks like we won't be able to tour for at least a year. So mm-hmm. we're getting holds in case it's possible to tour in a year. And it's my plan to have two albums to draw from by the time we can play live again.
Wow. All right. That's awesome. That's great. Congrats on all that. I'm glad. It's interesting, right? We've been given a bit of time. I know it seems like things are suspended, but I feel like we have time. Don't you feel that way?
I mean, I definitely think, especially at the beginning of the pandemic, I had time to think about what I wanted to do next. And as you asked me before, you know, what's the difference between working on my own projects versus working for other people? I think that right now there's a symbiotic relationship, and I'm kind of playing with what the right balance is as far as how much time I want to be spending on my own stuff versus working with other folks. And I think when I started making the album, I was probably spending 70% of my time servicing other people's projects and 30% on my own. And ultimately I want to flip that ratio, but the next step is getting to 50-50, which is about where I'm at right now. And it feels good, and it makes me better at servicing other people's projects to have my own outlet, just because it keeps me creatively stimulated in a different way. And it also, you know, creates a situation where I can get my own ideas out into the world. And I don't feel like I need to inject myself into other people's projects. But it also gives me a sense of what I'm uniquely qualified to offer to other people.
That sounds okay. Good. No, that's great. I'm glad that you've, reached certain conclusions about how your work intersects and you know, can be, I guess, most efficient, so to speak. As we're speaking, when was the last time you released a new episode of your podcast?
I think it was 2 weeks ago, and that was the Steve Jordan episode.
Right. So, when do you imagine, as we're speaking, when do you imagine the show might sort of be back, or another episode might be posted?
Well, I have something like 15 in the can, and I think we'll go back to the daily episodes sometime soon, maybe next week. We'll go back to the daily episodes for a while and see how it goes from there. But, it's great because I think, you know, I haven't taken many breaks from it, but when I have, the audience stays there. And I think we started the show before there was the glut of podcasts that there are now, and I'm fortunate that we have a relatively a pretty loyal audience.
Yeah, well, that's great. Okay, so we'll look out for it's for those who don't know, it's called The Trap Set with Joe Wong. So that's available on all the podcast platforms. If you want to direct people to learn more about Night Creatures and your own work, Joe, where would you like to send them?
They can go to Night Creatures, and Night is spelled NITE.com, or they can follow me on social media.
Yeah.
I'm at The Trap Set.
Okay. All right. So you're, yeah. Okay. At The Trap Set or nightcreatures.com. Joe, if we can go out on a song from this album, I wonder if you can choose one. And if so, if you can tell us why you chose it.
Let's go with The Long Parade, which is the penultimate song on the album. And the reason I'm choosing it is that it's kind of the most unobtrusive song on the album, but I think it has a deep meaning underneath the surface. And I've been enjoying playing it live. When we rehearsed and played with the quartet last week, it really felt good. And it's not one of the designated singles off the album. So why don't we go with that one?
Sure. Let's do it. This is The Long Parade from Night Creatures, great new album by Joe Wong. Joe, this was a pleasure. Thank you for making time for me on my podcast, and I wish you the best of luck with everything in the future.
Someday we'll have to reciprocate, and you can come on our podcast.
That would be lovely. I appreciate it. Thank you, Joe.
That's what we call in the podcasting industry a podcast 69. I just made that up.
It's vaguely dirty, but yes, I think that's what we call it. I'll have to check the podcast newsletter that we all subscribe to.
You never loved before. Demon knocked upon your door, and with the devil you'll stay. Follow the long parade into the sea. Be unafraid. You've always been someone to build the monster you were hiding from, and with the dead.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Very special thanks to Joe Wong for appearing on this, the 567th episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and is available on all Apple and Google platforms and other things as well. Spotify is among those other things. The show also has a modest YouTube page. The thing goes up on the YouTube. I don't do much gussying up. It just goes up. If you don't have any of those other things, but you have YouTube, you can listen to the shows. I put them up there with just like a photo, you know, it's just like a photo. And then the guest and I talk, it's the audio from the podcast. Anyway, it's on all those things. But if you can't find an episode that you've heard about and are looking for, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my semi-regularly scheduled newsletter, please visit my website, vishkana.com. You can like Creative Control on Facebook if you want to there. You can also follow the show on Twitter, at vishcreative, or follow me directly, at vishkana. Also, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to sustain this podcast. To keep it going, $6 or more gets you access to exclusive audio content. So consider that, or whatever you can afford, really. All of the financial support you provide does, in fact, keep the show on its feet. So again, patreon.com/creativecontrol to make your flexible monthly donation today, or now, even before the end of the day. Now would be good. Thanks again to liveatmatseyhall.com, where you can watch beautifully captured concerts by some great Canadian artists. Also, Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton for their in-kind support for the show. My dear old friend Jim Guthrie supplies some music for the show. You're hearing some of it in the background right now. Please head over to Jim's worldwide website, which is jimguthrie.org. Lots of great music there. He's got a nice Bandcamp page, too, very comprehensive. jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you. Thank you again for listening to this episode with Joe. Joe has a podcast called The Trap Set. No doubt some of you have checked in on this show because of his show. Well, feel free to check out this show, too. You might like it. I think Joe and I have some similar sensibilities, even some similar guests. So, yeah, check out the back catalog there. Tell your friends about the show, maybe. Subscribe to it. Those things. That's all helpful. Thank you very much for everything you do to be a good person, and I will talk to you very soon. Bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.